I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome once again to Football Belongs. I'm Richard Bayliss. Just a reminder, the podcast and chapter are different to each other, so we recommend you listen and read to get the full experience, in whichever order suits you. For now, though, it's over to your host, David Davutovic.
Thanks, Rich, and welcome to the penultimate Football Belongs podcast for this series. Today's theme is major events, and joining us are two of the protagonists from the unheralded 2015 Asian Cup. Ex-Socceroos coach Ange Postecoglou joins us from Yokohama. Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa, David, and that's as far as we'll go with the Japanese, mate.
Very good, same here. Football Australia chairman Chris Nicu, who was part of the 2015 Asian Cup organising committee. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Also joining us in the studio, sports reporter Richard Hines, who's covered major events extensively, home and abroad.
Good to be with you, David.
And the cast is incomplete without Football Belongs series author and inspiration, John Didelitzer. Welcome back.
Glad to say that I inspired so many things, David.
You've done a sterling job, JD, and we'll get on to another one in a moment. Now, John, the 2015 Asian Cup final, the pulsating game when James Troisi scored the dramatic extra time winner. That's the game you've chosen to cover through the major events lens. Why have you chosen this game?
Yeah, thanks, David. I think this whole series, there's two fundamental underpinnings of the Football Belongs concept. The first is that football is a fundamental part of the Australian experience. The second is, notwithstanding this, it continues to live outside the mainstream and sits outside our mainstream institutions. Now, through this series so far, and this will be the last of our substantive discussions, we looked at multiculturalism, and there's a compelling argument that but for football, Australia doesn't become the multicultural paradise that it is. You know, the destiny of the First Nations people is vastly different but for football. It's inspiration of someone like Charles Perkins to go to university, to become a leader of his community, to force the referendum in 77, but play a major role. The way football's been able to transcend state borders that we don't see in other areas. So gender equality through the Matildas. Soccer has played this enormous role in shaping modern Australia, yet it sits outside our mainstream. And major sporting events speaks to that theme incredibly loudly, in that a critical thread of being Australian, of growing up Australian, is tracking our success or otherwise at major sporting events. It's assessing our hosting of major sporting events. It's attending those events. So how do we assess the Asian Cup through that prism? How did it push? Yeah, because objectively, it was an incredible success. Yet we look back now, 6 or 7 years on, and the statue at the front of a stadium is not James Troisi scoring a goal, it's Billy Slater and the other guy, Cameron Smith. Out at Amy Park. So speaking personally, the Olympic Games, the Commonwealth Games, shaped my perceptions of being Australian more than anything. We took enormous pride in hosting the events in Sydney, and even speaking to my grandfather about Melbourne. The fact we introduced colour TV to ensure it coincided with the 1956 Olympics. There's been this massive social shift through Australia as a consequence of these major events, of which soccer has been a massive part. You know, the largest attendance at the 56 Olympics was the final that was played between Russia and the Soviet Union then in Yugoslavia. The opening match of the Sydney 2000, or the opening event of Sydney 2000, was a soccer game between Australia and Italy at the MCG. So the question then is, why hasn't the Asian Cup delivered the same type of isn't it embedded in Australian life the same way those events was, given the wonderful success that it was?
Very good. We'll delve into that Asian Cup of 2015 in a moment, the wonderful tournament that it was. But first, can I get each of you to reflect on what major events meant for you growing up? Ange Postecoglou, let's start with you.
Yeah, it's, you know, going on from what JD was saying, I mean, it was such a ingrained part of sort of growing up in Australia. I mean, aside from the kind of football aspect, because to me, you know, obviously the World Cup in 74 is currently the first sort of major tournament I remember having a massive impact on me. But then, it was always the things we hosted in Australia that inevitably made an impact and permeated through all your life. I mean, bizarrely, and to just give you an example, I'm obviously Greek born my old man sort of sporting landscape was football, followed by football, followed by football. growing up in Melbourne, it's you get exposed to so many things. And as a young guy, not just me, I think all the guys of my generation, we got such a wonderful kaleidoscope of sports that we could fall into. And the major events played a big part in that. So if I even something like a Commonwealth Games, and this is where I think it gets really bizarre as to how much sport plays a part in your upbringing, particularly here in Australia, is that if I mention a name like Rob Perella,
who was a Lawn Bowls champion.
He's done it again. He has done it again. Two magnificent bowls from Perella.
What the hell should a Greek-born kid and a Croatian kid know about lawn bowls? Seriously. And if I say the name Rob Perella, we all know who it is. Oh. Right? And we have nothing in common with that sport, that whole way of thinking. But yeah. I guarantee you that JD and all the guys, we set up a little lawn bowls thing in our hallway and we were trying to replicate what Rob Perella was doing. Now, that goes to show you the effect sport has on the Australian upbringing, or used to have. I kind of think society's changed a little bit in Australia, but that's how much we were so enraptured by sport. And that's the impact of major events, you know. So then, of course, you go on to the Olympics and your Cathy Freeman moments and all those kind of things obviously influence you amazingly in the whole country. But it was even those moments of, like I said, a Commonwealth Games. For me, from a football perspective, the World Youth Cup we had in Australia was also a massive thing, because all of a sudden that what we loved about our game, that international perspective, came to our, you know, right on into our living rooms and our not just our living rooms, because it wasn't our living room, sorry, but into our backyards.
81 or 93, you're referring to, Ange?
81 for me. That was the one, because we had Steve Blair in it, and Blair was a bit of a hero of mine, and I ended up playing with him, and he's kind of one of the biggest influences in my football career. And just watching play, I remember the final, you know, West Germany against Qatar was pelting down with rain. I mean, but this was the world game in our you know, backyard. And like I said, when a Commonwealth Games can have that much of an impact on me with a sport like lawn bowls, imagine what it did have in football there. And it certainly played a massive role, I guess, in my upbringing, sport in general. I mean, obviously football is my main sport, but that Australian sort of pride in anything we did on an international stage, was something that I think certainly benefited me in my life and in my professional life, but also in shaping me and my childhood. Because back then, I think growing up, to be Australian meant that, you know, you took pride in these things. And it's why it was always such a barrier for me when I got older and seeing why football couldn't penetrate in the same way.
Chris, not sure if you want to expand on your lawn bowls knowledge, but what did major events mean to you as a kid?
Cracker Jack, the movie?
No. look, for me growing up, things were on a four-year cycle. You had the Olympics every 4 years, you had the World Cup, and you hung out for those to come around. And they were 2 years apart, basically, and life went around those. And the Olympics in particular brought to the surface sports that most of us didn't necessarily follow day to day, but there was great national pride in the Australian teams competing, no matter what it was. So certainly that's shaped
my experiences. I think like most of us, we like sport generally. For many of us, it's around football. But those two events, throwing the Commonwealth Games, are the moments that bring Australians together with national pride.
Richard Hines?
Yeah, I've probably got a slightly different perspective. I grew up in a little country town. So everything that wasn't in the 70s, you know, Warwickville versus Dimboola at Anzac Park on a Saturday afternoon was hugely exotic and new to us. So everything televised that we came through. I remember probably the most kind of seminal event of that period was the Montreal Olympics in 1976, where Australia flopped horribly. Mm. And I remember sitting in, they actually put the TV up on the big stand in the classroom so we could watch Steve Holland win what would have been Australia's only gold medal. And of course, he got beaten by the American. and that, I think, predicated the building of the Australian Institute of Sport, because we'd gone so badly. Fraser coughed off a lot of money.
And that's critical. Sorry to cut you off there, Richard. That's like a critical theme of this, is that our inability to compete successfully at that level instigated broad social policy change.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the creation of the Australian Sports Commission and so on.
Yeah, it did in Olympics. And that's a recurrent theme with Olympics regenerating over various periods. But the one event I do really remember that probably cuts to this program is 1973, watching in my bedroom on a little black and white TV, Jimmy Mackay score the winner to get Australia into the its first World Cup. And this predates the John Aloisi moment. And to me, it's almost bigger in my mind than the Aloisi moment, because it was so rare, so exotic, seeing this guy and this grainy footage from Hong Kong against South Korea score this goal. And none of us in this little country town really had seen football. We would have called it soccer then, played it. But the next day in the playground, we're all mucking around with a soccer ball. But cutting to your theme, why doesn't that resonate further? Why hasn't events that have occurred beyond that occurred further? And it, you know, I know we're going to have a larger conversation about this, but that's the one that probably is the first, well ahead of the Asian Cup experience, about the possible bubble being created but not going to that next level.
A bit of self-promotion, or Optus promotion anyway. The late Jimmy Mackay and the Scottish cohort will feature as part of the Football Belongs Series 2 videos, which will be coming out shortly, starting in April, so look out for those. The 2015 Asian Cup, it was an unbelievable tournament. The Socceroos won, of course, thanks largely to the great Ange Postecoglou, who's joining us today. On and off the field, it was unbelievable. I'll run through some stats. So 2.5 billion TV viewers globally, compared to 3.7 billion for the 2000 Olympics and 1.5 billion for the 2018 Commonwealth Games. Aggregate crowd attendance of 650,000, and Chris can talk to this, but I think the LOC forecast around 350,000, so a massive uplift on initial projections. Commonwealth Games, for instance, had 331,000 visitors. And if you compare it to the 2007 Rugby League World Cup, 382,000 fans went through the gates. So certainly dominated conversation on social media with fans over the continent. 13 million minutes of event action watched on the official YouTube channel, and the official hashtag had a reach of 3.5 billion. So whichever way you carve it up, those numbers were massive. Now, Ange, I'll throw to you. You understand sense of occasion better than most coaches and better than most, full stop. What did the Asian Cup mean to you? Because you seem to have an eye on it from the moment you were appointed Socceroos boss.
Yeah, I did. I'll be honest. I mean, when I got appointed, I mean, as people remember, it was kind of, you know, we'd already qualified for the World Cup, and we'd had a couple of pretty bad defeats, and you know, the FFA decided to move on Holger, and there was a lot of discussion at the time about, you know, and a lot of advice to me that, you know, it was better I kind of skipped the World Cup, that they appointed a, you know, Van Marwijk type for the World Cup, and then, you know, I take over for after that to prepare for the Asian Cup and use the Asian Cup as a preparation to build a new team. And, you know, I was having none of that. I thought it was a wonderful, yeah, sorry, which is not surprising by me, but anyway, I kind of saw, well, I got 15 months to win an Asian Cup here, and why would I waste the opportunity to kind of test ourselves at a World Cup? And if I'm going to regenerate this team, you know, give them some real heat and exposure in the highest possible level, I mean, that can only be a positive thing. I didn't see a downside to it. I think, you know, people were more worried about me and potentially us, you know, copping a drubbing in a World Cup, and how would that affect my sort of reputation, my ability to sort of build things. And I remember when I did sit down with, you know, Sir Frank Lowy and even David Gallop, you know, they were kind of, and certainly Frank was very sort of persistent in saying, look, are you sure, you know, we can, you've got the job after the World Cup. Don't stress about it. We're not going to change our minds. You know, he'd sort of set his heart on having an Australian coach. So, you know, you don't have to do the World Cup. And like I said, for me, I thought the Asian Cup was an unbelievable opportunity. And look, maybe I kind of romanticised it in my head a little bit that winning it would be something that would be a seminal moment in Australian football, knowing how I knew the tournament would be a success, because we always hold, every tournament we host in any sport is always successful because of the public getting so sort of enraptured in anything like that. And I thought if we can win it on home soil, winning it's great, but winning it on home soil would be a seminal moment. So I kind of had a 15-month plan of, okay, everything we do from now on, and you know, every decision we make is about making sure we have a good crack at it. And, you know, we didn't have a great build-up in terms of results along the way, particularly in 2014. You know, we did the World Cup, we didn't win there, and then we didn't win, I think we won one game the whole 12-month calendar leading into the Asian Cup. And, you know, I've said it a few times, I'd had discussions with Frank, and it was pretty clear for Frank, this was it for him. You know, I got a sense from him that this is the one he wanted to win, and he would probably walk away. So, and you know, anyone who's met Frank will know he's pretty old school. He's a different generation. You know, my father's generation. Pretty straightforward, and that kind of works with me anyway. I kind of work well in that sort of scenario, and he would make it pretty clear that Ange. At the beginning, he was saying, look, it's something I want to win. And I said, well, that's what I plan to do. And then the results weren't coming in the build-up. And he'd kind of say, well, are we going to make semi-finals? And I said, don't worry, we'll make semi-finals. We'll win it, you know. And then I think the last meeting I had to him, he said, look, I don't want to be embarrassed. He said, I'm going to have people from all around the world. I don't want to be embarrassed. Make sure you don't, you know. I said, look, I appreciate the support, Chairman, but, you know, my plan is to win it. And, you know, I had this mission that, like I said, I felt it was a real opportunity, a seminal moment. And, you know, as people know, I was born in Greece, and I saw the way they still talk about the Euros, winning the Euros in Greece. And they've only qualified for a couple of World Cups like us, I think three. You know, so for them, qualifying for the World Cup is great. But if you ask any Greek what's the greatest moment in Greek football, it's winning the Euros. And I thought that would be sort of the impact we could have, you know, by winning the Asian Cup. So for me, it was the primary target when I first took over. That was for me the thing that I wanted to complete above everything else.
Chris Nicker, you're nodding and smiling next to me here.
I'm listening there with interest, because probably now's a good time to share what the inner thinking was around the Asian Cup. So Frank trying to keep a lid on things. I think the pass mark was the quarterfinals. The semis would have been fantastic, and there was no talk about actually making the final. And
yeah,
I'm sitting there thinking, I'm pretty sure that's not the way the coach is thinking. I think Ange hit the nail on the head from Sir Frank's perspective. It was the first chance for Australia, as still a relatively new member of the AFC, to discharge their social responsibility and putting on a tournament. And obviously, he didn't want to be embarrassed in that sense. But I think even he would say he was didn't script the ending and winning it. He hoped for it, but the fact that it came was unbelievable.
So anything less than quarterfinals, and Ange would have got the bullet.
I'm not sure how his bonus scheme worked. I'd have to go back and look at his contract. But no, it was always going to the finals.
Richard Hines, you've covered many major events in your time. What was your sense of the Asian Cup leading into it?
It's funny, I had an interesting build-up to it, because I was at the very last minute sent to Riyadh for the in 2014 for the Asian Champions League final to see the Wanderers somehow hang on after 25 shots, you know, and some fairly handy refereeing.
It's unbelievable scenes here. The miracle has happened. Western Sydney Wanderers have unbelievably lifted the AFC Champions League against all the odds.
But it was one of the most amazing events I've ever been to. Just the crowd, the build up, being in, if you've ever been to Riyadh, you know, just what a surreal place it is. And for an Australian team to, who were basically captive in their hotel for a week, Journo's dream, we had them all there. They were asking to be interviewed by the end. It was great. But for them to win that, it just gave me a real taste. As an outsider, I'm a generalist, as you know, I'm not a football writer per se. And it gave me a real sense of what's going on in Asia, what the possibilities were. And then I remember coming back and there was a launch where Michael Brown and I think Alison Hill, who was working, they did a really good job. And I could tell that the tournament was going to be really well connected with community. They did a great job setting it up, aligning countries with teams, you know, it's kind of adopt a team or, you know, align your local nationals with that team. If they were in the the Cup, they went into schools. I could tell that. I was just always worried whether Australia, though, had a sense like I did of how big this was. And we were already in an era where Asian Champions League games in Australia against A-League teams were played before crowds of 2,000 or 3,000 on a Wednesday night. And I think it was because people didn't have a sense of what the competition was. I don't know whether it was the timing or whatever, but we didn't understand Asia. And it was like 20, 30 years after Paul Keating had dragged us into Asia, we viewed our achievements in Asia when we were in Asia. And I think, you know, Ange's achievement over there was rightly lauded and he did it in Asia. But we don't see Asia coming here as being the same thing. We don't really see ourselves as Asia in that way. And so I worried about it from that perspective in a sense, but also saw the great possibilities of it having had that amazing experience in Riyadh.
John, what were you thinking leading into the tournament?
Yeah, I wasn't. I was probably preoccupied with a million other things, to be honest. I was trying to run an A-League club at the time, and anyone who's been involved in an A-League club, you understand that your chance to actually even speak to your partner and your kids becomes zero. So it sort of snuck up on me, to be honest. I think my greatest disappointment was Aaron Moy wasn't picked, Ange. That's probably the one thing that sticks in my head about the tournament. I think Antonis came in as the sort of 23rd man at Moy. And I remember thinking, how the hell is he watching the A-League or what? You know, Moy's just cutting it up and he's playing unbelievable. Anyway, but what struck me most was that...
How long have you wanted to get that off?
Yeah, a long, long time, Ange.
You don't understand how many times he's mentioned that to me, Ange.
How did he get picked? Like, I remember thinking, like...
As a City fan, I'll back him up. 100%. You got that one right.
I even... Because he actually scored... as we came back, because we sort of had a few weeks off, and came back after the final, and he scored this ripper against the Wanderers. He sort of cut in on his right, went bang! And look, now when I speak on these podcasts, I try to pull out my polished, you know, professional voice, but it was very much time. What the hell's going on, man? How did he not play? How did he not get picked? I was apoplectic, but anyway.
Give Ange a right of reply.
No. I say that in jest. I think the main thing was, what I'm saying is that I was sort of preoccupied with stuff, and it wasn't until I sat down to watch the final that I thought, okay, great, here we go. And I remember viewing it thinking, this is on par with what I'd seen at the World Cup in 2006. The sense of occasion, the build-up, the people in the stadium. There was this gravity to the game that I hadn't really picked up. I mean, I'd sort of watched, you know, the Timmy goal against China was incredible. I'd gone to the games in Melbourne, you know, in between whatever I was doing. And, you know, it was there, but I wasn't totally embedded to it. But when that game happened, I thought, mate, the same as you thought, Ange, I thought this is a seismic moment for the sport. We've conquered one of our Everests, and here's a chance now to actually... build on this. And it should, in my mind, it should have been one of those signs on the roadmap that says we're now here, we've arrived, because the game itself was just as good a game of football as I've ever watched. I mean, I always count my favourite games as being Australia-Japan at the World Cup in 2006, Australia-Croatia from 2006, and also the Australia-Brazil game from the Women's World Cup last year when we won 3-2 after being 2-0 down. And that game, this game that we're talking about now, sits alongside that. The drama, the quality, the sense of occasion, the opposition were great. Like, it was our fierce Asian rival. Sun scored the equaliser in, what, David, the
91st minute.
So the game itself was just off the radar. And I've always wondered now when I reflect, okay, in the moment I thought, yeah, here we are. And 6 years on, I'm thinking, okay, why didn't it embed itself as one of these moments that turns the tide for Australian football?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I've got a theory as always, but I'll share that later on.
We've got a bit of time. Like Richard, I was a little bit concerned leading into the tournament, being low-key. But once it kicked off, it was a massive event. And my highlight of the tournament, aside from the Socceroos, obviously, was that cracking game in Canberra, Iran versus Iraq, where Iraq won on penalties. That game had it all. The atmosphere was absolutely electric. But, Chris, from an organising committee's viewpoint, what was the feeling beforehand, and how did you feel once the event started?
Yeah, so unlike, say, the Women's World Cup that's coming, this was a local organising committee one, so it was heavily funded by state and federal governments. So we had those representatives sitting in the board meetings making sure we're making sound decisions. So we weren't worried about attendances at the Socceroos matches. We always felt they would be well attended, but getting bums on seats and putting on a good spectacle was a priority. And you mentioned Michael Brown before. He did a lot of work going up and down the country and connecting communities, and that meant that they did turn out for the games. And but there was a lot of work behind the scenes to get it to that level.
Once we got to the final, it was a massive occasion. I believe we were all at the event. Were you there, Richard?
Yeah, I was.
Fantastic. It was
not me, David. Watch it from home, just so you know.
Working feverishly. So over 76,000.
About Aaron Moore. Right?
He boycotted.
Quick write and reply, Ange, if you like.
No, mate. I've never said I was perfect. I get something wrong. My old man, passed away, but he said to me, I've said the story, I gave him the medal. He said, look, if you'd made better decisions, it wouldn't have gone into extra time. So I'm kind of used to that. I'm kind of used to that kind of feedback, mate, from people. So it's all good. It's all good.
Didn't he say if you had Aaron Moore, it wouldn't have gone to extra time?
Yeah, probably. It's probably one of the decisions, yeah.
Well, one guy whose selection had no conjecture at all was Mus Luongo. He got the player of the tournament, scored the opening goal in the 45th minute. A cracking goal as well. The first touch when Trent Sainsbury drilled in that pass and scored from outside the box.
Oh, lovely little turn from Luongo!
And then Song Hyun-min obviously equalised 91st minute, just as a few people, I'm not sure what Ange was thinking at the time, were thinking about holding that cup aloft. But of course, it went into extra time, and James Troisi hitting home the winner from Tommy Urich's cross.
Spin play, risky play, and the Mugler tap it.
Ange, your reflections of that game itself?
Yeah, look, it was, we obviously, like I said, in my mind, that's where I pictured us. But obviously, when you're going through the tournament, and we kind of grew into the tournament from the first game, we were really good. And then we lost to South Korea in the last group game. But, I rested a few that day because I thought, well, if we're going to go deep in the tournament. So I remember, I think I left out Timmy and Millet and a couple of others. And we lost 1-0, but, we gave a good account of ourselves. So then the quarters and the semis, we were pretty strong. But I had no doubt that South Korea were a fantastic side. So I knew we were a challenge. But, my sort of thought process is going to all big games is pretty much the same, is that you just my history, I guess, in the game is that every sort of big game I've been involved in, there's always been some drama attached to it. And, I think... during the game, the game was a pretty tight one. And they were a fantastic team and they put us under a little bit of pressure, but we coped okay. Like you said, we scored. But, I got this uneasy sense probably with 10 minutes to go that, the story wasn't over. Just like I said, just because of my history in sort of big games. And as you mentioned, the trophy was literally within touching distance of me. So, they bloody bought it out with 10 minutes to go, which I got annoyed with. It's kind of just... It was just too close to me for me to feel comfortable. And how football works. I mean, that's the beauty of it, is that one moment can change everything. And, when they scored, I just felt that the energy sort of sap out of the whole stadium. And, even with the players, you know, you're kind of thinking to be so close. I was literally within touching distance of the trophy, but even metaphorically, we were, you know, we were a minute away from doing something special. And then, yeah, you got to regroup your thoughts. And probably because I always prepare myself for you know, the most unique of circumstances. You know, by the time the players came in after the game, I had a look around and I had no doubt we had it in us to win that game in extra time. And, you know, the Koreans had given everything to sort of stay with us. And, you know, once James scored and, you know, we were pretty comfortable after that. We actually played some of our best football in extra time, I thought. And, you know, then the whistle goes and it's you know, anyone who's been in that situation will tell you that sense of relief that comes over you, particularly when you're a coach, is just enormous.
Australia has done it. The Socceroos, kings of the continent for the first time. They're the champions of Asia in 2015.
You don't realise how much you carry on you and you know, people think it's a euphoric feeling. It actually isn't. It's more of a, you know, just a release of tension and everything that's been built up. And I enjoy those moments because I usually just sit back and just watch everyone else sort of celebrating and just seeing how happy it makes people. And obviously I had family, friends in the crowd there, my wife and, you know, all those people close to me. So it definitely makes it more special when it happens at home. And it was a great day. It was a great game. I mean, I like all those things that happened in my life, I've never watched the game again. You know, every now and then the highlights will come across my sort of path, but I've never rewatched the whole game because those kind of games are perfect memories for me. And if I watch it again, I'll probably start sort of analysing where we could have been better. And I don't want to do that. It's kind of a perfect memory for me.
Yeah, and listening to the post-match interview just recently, you certainly were emotional, Ange, as emotional as I've heard you. And there was that fantastic moment in extra time or in between, just before extra time, when you got the players in and you gave them the big rev up, and we saw the South Korean players down on the deck. That seemed to be a real turning point.
I kind of said to the players that, you know, it was, we were writing a, you know, I said that when the history of football gets written in Australia, there'll be a chapter on the 2015 Asian Cup, and we were writing that chapter, you know. And I'd always said to them that, you know, we could make it one of the best chapters in the book if we did special things. And it's what I said to them at full time. I said, look, you know, we can make this now the real perfect ending, because, you know, like all perfect endings, there's always a little bit of a twist, you know, and our twist is that we've got to come back from this. And we'd worked hard for 15 months to prepare them for extra time and whatever else needed to happen for us to win that game. So, you know, whether they heard me in that moment or they didn't, I think they heard from me enough to believe that, you know, I don't think the words on that moment really made the impact. It was more, you know, what we'd done in the lead up that, you know, they believed. Like I said, every one of them was on their feet waiting for me to talk. And I did look at the Koreans and they were out on their feet because they'd given everything. And, you know, there were some strong leaders in that group and, you know, we got our rewards.
I want to get onto the legacy from the 2015 World Asian Cup in a moment, but any observations from that game, any memories, boys?
Richard? Well, other than Ange setting an A qualifier for the Olympic 100 metres down the sidelines, which was a highlight for everyone, I think. We replayed that a few times on Offsiders the next day. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I looked at the highlights again this morning on YouTube, just the 3 or 4 minute clip just to prompt my memory. And one thing that really struck me, and this might sound a bit counterintuitive, but when Sun scored, the noise in the stadium is enormous. Like there's a lot of, you know, Korean fans there and neutrals and so forth. And it just reminded me of what, this sounds really funny, but it was kind of like a happy occasion both ways. You know, there's often in football, there's a bit of angst either way and whatever, but it was just such a celebration that day. I remember in the stands and whichever way it went, I think because the tournament itself had gone so well, Australia had reached, I think the final was always seen as the absolute minimum, reached that final game. And the win was obviously an enormous achievement and bonus. Ange wouldn't see it that way, but I think for outsiders, It was just a happy day, and a happy day for football. And I really, you know, that's my abiding memory. So hearing the crowd even cheer as loudly as they did for what would have been, could have potentially been a horrible moment if it had taken the game away from Australia, was really kind of surprising, but in kind of in line with my memory.
Not a bad player, Son Heung-min, is he? There was a carnival atmosphere to that tournament, Chris.
Yeah, well, I was actually sitting next to representatives of the broadcaster, right? So, and the game was 1-0. It's gone into 90 minutes, and we're all looking at the clock thinking, let this game finish. And when that equaliser went in, a lot of the oxygen in the stadium got sucked out, right? Because we thought, oh, God, here we go. The only ones happy were the broadcaster because, as they said at the time, you beauty, another half hour of this stuff, and it's riding its socks off, right? So, but for the rest of us, it was a very anxious period.
Yeah, I really loved it because I felt it rounded out what was an incredibly good tournament. Like the Iran versus Iraq game was one of the most dramatic. Mm. I don't know if you've got the stats there, Dave. You call your company Bruce Media because you name yourself after the great Bruce McAvaney. So I'm sure you've got some stat in there somewhere. But the Iran Iraq game was like breathtaking. It was one of the most dramatic matches I've ever watched. So there was such a critical mass of support, passion, love for the tournament, that it was a perfect finale. It really was. It could not have been. You know, I often ask people why there aren't more. I often debate with people why there aren't more sports movies made, given sports such a big part of our cultural existence. There's so few sports movies compared to rom-coms and thrillers and whatever else. It's because the stuff that happens on the field can't match fiction. Like, you couldn't be able to script that finale. And, you know, the question is, and as you were posing now, is what was the natural extension of that, and how do we actually start embedding those moments as part of the Australian zeitgeist? Because at the moment, we're grappling with that. You know, what should have been the high watermark of the game, and we'd all agree that that was the high watermark of the game. We haven't transcended, or certainly not, you know, through osmosis even, entered the mainstream of Australian society culturally.
I'll throw to Chris first, yeah. Considering you're on the organising committee. Can you just talk to the legacy of the 2015 Asian Cup in a moment? And we will touch on the 2023 World Cup later on.
It depends how you look at legacy. Clearly, I would have liked to have seen some more done in the physical sense. And I think that was partly to do because of the way it was structured, where the discussion on legacy was actually occurred after the event, because that's the way the funding ran. But if you're asking me now, sitting on the AFC Exco, what's been the legacy, I think it's actually helped establish Australia in the AFC. We were the new kids on the block. I don't think we would have got the support for something like the Women's World Cup that we did. If people remember, at the start of the Women's World Cup bidding process, there were four Asian countries, the two Koreas, Japan and Australia. And I think putting on a tournament like that gave us greater standing and imprimatur with the AFC. And I think that ultimately helped us. So in an intangible sense, that was a plus. In a tangible sense, I think there's work that should have been done to get a better result.
Ange Postecoglou, I'll give your book a plug, Changing the Game, for those who haven't read it. A must read. I know you touched on the Asian Cup in there, but I guess what, 6 or so years on, how do you reflect on the Asian Cup from a legacy viewpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to look at it. I mean, I think, you know, Chris kind of outlined, I think there was a legacy in terms of the tournament was well run. Our reputation within Asia, I think, was certainly enhanced. But I've said it before, I felt there was no football legacy. There was nothing that was tangible for the game, not just in a material sense. You know, the next day, you know, the nature of the Socceroos is the next day they all got back on planes and sort of went back to their, you know, destinations all over the world, back to their clubs. I mean, there was no, you know, there was no dinner at Kirribilli House or wherever else they have these things. There was no honours bestowed upon anybody in that group. There was no, you know, understanding of the magnitude of the achievement, the magnitude in the way I saw it. Obviously, others maybe saw it differently. None of that existed. And for me, that was probably, like I said, I'd built myself up to make it this seminal moment. You know, probably from the day after, I kind of realised that I'd fooled myself maybe to think in that way, because just to achieve it, maybe thinking, making it a bigger thing in my mind than actually what it in real terms it was and is. I mean, I think it was probably 3 or 4 months later, I actually traveled to Korea because I was doing some scouting, around the Asian region for the World Cup qualifiers. And I went to a national team Korean game, a friendly game they were playing. And I remember walking to the stadium, there was this, 40-metre poster of Ole Stilica, their coach, at the entrance, and another 50-metre sort of banner of Key, the captain, and Son. And it struck me there, I thought, geez, we will never see that in Australia. We beat this team, we were the conquerors, and yet the way they were, just for making the final, treated in their home country, I just thought, it just, like I said, it was for me, and probably that was more an internal thing for me. I'd built it up that literally from the day after, it kind of dawned on me that it wasn't what I thought it would be, and it didn't have the effect I thought it would be. Now, the reasons why, have been discussed many times, and JD can articulate it better than me and probably pose the questions more than give the answers about why. I definitely think it was a missed opportunity on many fronts. It was indicative of where the game's been for a long time, in that we just haven't understood the football significance of things and the soul of football and what it can do and what it can mean within ourselves as a community. Forget, we kind of always looking for acknowledgement from outside and other codes and other sports and the general Australian public, whatever that means. But even as a football community, I don't think we've understood the soul of what the game is and have missed many opportunities to kind of understand the impact that the sport can have on lives if we herald our own, if we give ourselves some self-respect and self-esteem and sort of walk out with our heads held high that we've done something special. It's almost like within our own game, we kind of keep our heads down and make sure we don't stick them up too high in case we get them knocked off. And so, yeah, for me, it was a little bit of a bittersweet experience, that whole thing. I love the build-up. I love the game. But after that, I just felt, you mentioned James Troisi, the goal he scored. Mastalongo was nominated for the Ballon d'Or not long after. I mean, an unbelievable, and rightly so. People may laugh because he was, where he is in the career. But those kind of things happen because people have special tournaments. Escalacci, his achievements at a World Cup are no less just because it happened at a World Cup. If anything, it's more. A Paolo Rossi, unbelievable moments. That was Mastalongo. For that 30 days, he was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And yet all those kind of things are all in my head, outside my head. I haven't seen them happen anywhere.
And he hasn't become the folk hero that a Robbie Perrella or a Dean Lucan or a Tracy Wickham has become because she won a couple of golds at the Comm Games in 82, and that's the whole essence of this debate is why hasn't a Mastalongo transcended into our cultural zeitgeist yet, a Robbie Perrella has, or a Lloydie. I remember now that middle distance runner, is it Simon Lloyd, or it was just Lloydie, it was just running into the home straight. You're like, why do I remember some skinny dude who was a middle distance runner who had no chance of ever making an Olympic final, yet I remember him winning a Comm Games gold, and that's, I think, the heart of this debate is why not?
Richard,
but just even in terms of the football industry, our community, JD, is that we're almost embarrassed by it because then when we say Mastalongo, they say, yeah, but he's never played in the Premier League, he's never played, for a big club. Why are you putting him up? And we're afraid to go that extra step and say, no, mate, you're wrong. It's got nothing to do with the Premier League. It's got to do with that. A guy like Son was in the tournament as well, and yet he wasn't the player of the tournament. Mastalongo was for that 30 days. It doesn't matter. But we're not strong enough with that within our own football community. We're embarrassed. I remember this Ballon d'Or at the time. We were embarrassed. We were saying it was almost like a sort of a quirky thing that we didn't want to be associated with, that an Australian player has got to that level. We're not comfortable with it, and we should be, because the achievement is the achievement. This is being adjudicated by people who have nothing to do with us that they're putting his name up.
Yeah, it's got echoes of a previous topic that we covered of cultural cringe. There's a real convergence with the themes that you're discussing now, Ange, and that whole notion of cultural cringe that we have that's anchored back, in my view, into this colonialism that acts as a barrier on modern Australia. I mean, we don't rate what we do in Asia because we don't rate Asia as a nation, as a culture. Asia is there to be conquered. That's our colonial anchor as a community. Asia's not there to be a peer. Asia's not there to be anything. But, you know, you look at, like, education's another great example, is we don't look to Singapore for education guidance, yet they're the best. They've got the best education system in the world. We look to Asia for fee fodder to bring in students that we can churn through and get fees from. We're continually seeking to appease this mythical English gentleman that may or may not exist. And that's exactly Ange's point, and I couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. And I think that sits at the essence of why something like the Asian Cup doesn't resonate, why the heroes of that tournament don't resonate the way they should.
Richard Hines?
Yeah, if you don't mind me kind of broadening it a little bit, because legacy's been a real hobby horse of mine in my writing days, but can you imagine a better event than the Sydney 2000 Olympics? I mean, it just had everything. Great moments. Cathy Freeman wins.
Cathy lifting, goes up to Graham, takes the lead, looks a winner, draws away from Graham and Mary. This is a famous victory, a magnificent performance. What a legend. What a champion.
People are laughing at Roy and HG. You know, it just had feel-good stories, international acclaim.
Simpsons
everything
on Fox 8.
Everything. It had everything you could have in an event. So what's the legacy of that event? The supposition has always been, oh, more Australians will, you know, run and do all these Olympic events, we'll get better and stronger and so forth. Absolutely not. I mean, I remember after this and in some subsequent investigations, I struggled to find any studies that had been made, because the AOC deliberately don't do studies because they know what the answer is going to be. It's nothing. I think the University of New South Wales did a study that showed people walked a little bit more for about 6 months afterwards. So why is this? Kids do turn up at a little athletic centre for a while. They realise it's kind of pretty boring because they don't have funding. They haven't moved on from the 1970s. There's lots of kids standing around. They're in long lines because the money hasn't been invested. There's no equivalent of an Auskick or whatever the rugby league thing is, or cricket blast in cricket, or Joey's, or, you know, whatever the football equivalents are, because there's been no investment whatsoever at the grassroots, so it doesn't grow. They made the infrastructure investment, in my mind, was a disaster because of the home bush element. It was they allowed the AFL to hijack what should have been a rectangular stadium and turn it into an oval without the utility for the predominant codes in the city. So Olympic legacy is an absolute myth in so many ways. But what happens? They get bailed out. And we mentioned it before, 1976. That was only 20 years after Melbourne. Melbourne, again, of its time, was similar to Sydney in an event, but it didn't have the traction that 20 years later we weren't even winning a single gold medal. What happens? The government provides the AIS, enormous funding for Olympics, and off we go again. Because we get the Olympics in 2000, more government funding, off we go again. And now we're at 220 and we're struggling in a lot of these Olympic sports because they don't have the traction, because the AOC doesn't empower its sports. It smothers them. It doesn't give them any incentive to grow themselves. What does football learn from this? Well, the question for football, I guess, is why isn't it getting the same lift that the Olympics get, those Olympic sports? And I know part of the answer is heritage, the feel-good factor. I mean, John Coates, the AOC head, can literally stand in Parliament and say, I report to Switzerland, not Australia, and the legacy of my Olympics is a feel-good factor. He doesn't have to give a single justification for the hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent on Olympic sports. Football? Crazy. You know, every cent is now being eked out. And I think, to be fair, I think one great opportunity lost was the World Cup bid. And I think, you know, we can talk about it endlessly, but I think a lot of political capital was burnt by going at that time we did and by the way it was done. But that's, you know, water under the bridge. But I guess the question football has to ask moving into an event like, and Chris will be asking it and acting on it, moving into an event like the 2023 World Cup, is how do we then leverage that that legacy? How do we have a real legacy? How do we make it go through the grassroots, through the infrastructure, not just the moments? Because Yeah, I remember Rob Perella and all of that, but I didn't go lawn bowling, and I'm not sure there was a, other than in Ange's lounge room, I'm not sure there was a massive lawn bowls boom at the time, maybe a little bit. But, yeah, they're the questions I think that need to be asked going forward, and the things that, you know, and they were probably impossible at the time in 2015. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if enough thought was given or it was just...
No, I think we've learnt lessons, Richard. I think that's true. As I said before, legacy was an after-the-fact discussion, whereas this time around, it's actually already occurred. We've already been to Parliament. There's a very dedicated legacy plan. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the stars are aligning. It's totally different to the Asian Cup in the sense that even before the announcement, immediately after the announcement, the metrics leading into the Women's World Cup are significantly different from the global broadcast to 400,000 more female participants by 27. Mm. The fact that it's feeding into an Asian Pacific step up, these sort of environmental factors, there'll be 3,000 more jobs, the contribution to the GDP much greater this time around, 320 million plus. These all help us put the narrative to government and not be embarrassed about our sport. I think we have a little bit of an inferiority complex still. I know that commercially, sponsors talking to us at head office, they're really interested in a couple of things. That is the national teams, and Matildas are very get a lot of traction, and grassroots community football. That's where a lot of corporates want to position their brand. And what better sport to do it than football, because it's the one that connects to the most communities around Australia. So we're getting the ear of government. We've actually seen it already. We've turned soil in WA in South Australia with Homes of Football, so that's good for those organisations. Here in Victoria, we're fairly down the track and advanced with Football Victoria and the home of the Matildas. And we've already commenced the lobbying and the business case around a national home of football, so that come 2023, we wouldn't be able to look each other in the eye and point and say, that's the physical legacy of a Women's World Cup.
That's good to hear because, to tie it in with 2015, if the legacy of 2023 is that if a young boy or girl turns up at a soccer club, a football club after that, having been inspired by seeing that, and it's easier, better, cheaper, you know, the pathway is improved than it was after watching Ange run up and down the sidelines like a madman in 2015, if it's easier for that kid, then to... That to me is a solid legacy.
Yeah, and we've done the analysis behind it. You know, only one in five clubs have actually got female-friendly facilities, and the governments are aware of that. So we can actually tell them where and which electorates they're short. So it's a much more sophisticated and detailed discussion at this time. Good.
The recent times has provided a timely contrast in how Australia views major events. Just under a year ago, where Australia and New Zealand won the co-hosting rights to the 2023 World Cup, and only a few months ago where the reports came out that Brisbane was in the box seat to host the 2032 Olympics. And I'm not sure about you guys, but in the mainstream media, there was a sense in my mind of a greater euphoria, greater coverage around the Olympics in some ways. So football has played a huge role in terms of the Olympics historically. JD, I might throw this one to you in terms of football's contribution, and we'll move on to the potential legacies as well from the 2023 World Cup.
Yeah, that's another dimension, is that football's played such a prominent role within the Olympic movement. I mean, obviously football's greatest stage doesn't feature within the Olympics per se, at least in the men's Olympics and women's Olympic, in terms of women's football, absolutely it does. But yeah, in 1956, the largest event was the soccer final, football final at the MCG. In Sydney 2000, we kicked off the tournament at the MCG with Australia versus Italy. And historically, the largest attended event at every single Olympics since football was introduced was football. Some great footballing moments also happened during the Olympics. The 1988 Olympics in Seoul, Australia beat Yugoslavia in the first game, and they were a fancied gold medal contender. We beat them and went through to the quarterfinals. We had the bronze medal playoff in 1992. So some of our best football moments too have also occurred during those tournaments. A Ned Zelich goal that qualified us for that tournament is folkloric within football. Yet again, football's role within the Olympic movement within Australia, in any case, has always been very shallow, or certainly not embraced as part of the real feats of success that we've had.
Ange, can we get your views?
Yeah, look, I think this whole sort of legacy aspect, I mean, I get where sort of Richard's coming from in terms of, you know, that, you know, people don't necessarily, you know, ride this wave of euphoria to the great beyond in terms of the impact it has. But I just look at it from my perspective. I still think that the actual sport and the person and how they're sort of perceived does make an impact in society. So another example, you know, Chris and I are a couple of kids raised by Greek parents. The only reason we played golf was because of Greg Norman. No other reason. There was nothing else pushing us, well, I should say badly to be fair, but there was nothing else pushing us to that sport but seeing the great white shark.
I like it. A lot.
Greg Norman! Tell me about it.
That had no relevance in my household. I could not speak to my father about golf. He'd give me a backhander even if I suggested it, right? But sitting in front of that screen and the way the great white shark was portrayed, we all got out, all of us, and it was, you know, four or five Greek kids playing golf. It shouldn't happen. But there was that was the impact that had. Football can have a greater impact. I'll tell you why, because once you start playing the game, irrespective of your age, it does stick to you. So if we can get, and that's why we've never had a problem about kids playing the game or at grassroots level. And that's why it's appealing to government. I get all that. And I understand all that, but that's always existed. My thing is, well, how can we create the Greg Norman so that that impact is long lasting, that impact has goes beyond in legacy in terms of the tangible material things of more corporate sponsorship, more government backing, but gets into the soul of the country where people want to be, you know, the closest we have is that John Aloisi moment. And that has an impact because when you talk to Jackson Irvine, he clearly remembers that moment and that inspired him. So there is something there that I don't think we've taken advantage of as a football community to understand that that's the biggest part of the legacy. When we're talking about 2023, I can tell you something now that it will be a hit. It will be an unbelievable tournament. You will have everybody watch you, the whole nation, even mainstream media, AFL people. They will love it because they've all got daughters. They've all got people who will be dragging them, and they'll love it because of what they see, the spectacle it is. It'll be a fantastic tournament. It'll be a fantastic games. What's our legacy from that going to be apart from that feel-good factor? And to me, is to make sure that if it's a Sam Kerr or whoever it is, they get raised to that level of a Don Bradman or whoever it is in the minds of Australian people, so that's how we raise the game to that legitimacy. And that comes from us. It won't come from an outside source. That comes from us raising them up. That's the legacy I'm talking about. Because when you have that sort of legacy, again, I'll go back to my Greg Norman. I guarantee you the impact Greg Norman had on golf in this country, on why are my mates buying memberships to golf clubs? Seriously, mate, it shouldn't be happening. It should not be happening. Not the way we were brought up, but it does. And I'm telling you, it starts from that. And football has never had that legacy, even though we have had opportunities to do it. Yep. We've just never capitalised.
Can I make one? It's not a counterpoint, but it's probably a complementary point. The reason the Greg Norman boom works so well in Australia is because Australia has the best public golf courses in the world. So when Greg Norman came along, you could wander over to Northcote Municipal or whatever and play for $10. Tiger Woods in America, there's no equivalence in South Central LA or whatever, and it didn't have that same effect. And that's just kind of a consequence of having the infrastructure. Mm. Coincidentally, it wasn't built because of Greg Norman, but when Norman came along, all the people who wanted to play could go to Wattle Park and hit it off those plastic mats or join a bigger course if it was there. So it's a complementary point that, yes, it does create that swell. But I guess my point too is the underlying things have to be there as well, whether it's the grassroots investment or the infrastructure. Otherwise, you don't take advantage of it, and the kids turn up at Little Ass and don't like it and go away. So that's what football, a challenge for football is.
I think, David, you need the catalyst that Ange is talking about. Cadell Evans, the same in cycling. He's born to all these mammals on Beach Road. But and then you need the infrastructure underneath it to trap it and keep them in there so it's not just a short-term influx and then they flow out and life goes on. I think that's the secret. The two need to go hand in hand.
Boys, it's been a fascinating discussion. I want to get your final observations. JD, I'll give you the option of going first or last.
I'll go first. I'll go first, David. Thank you. I'll leave the last words to more esteemed gentlemen than I. I think that football legacy is a really important discussion point. I think what you've raised here is really enlightening, this notion of combining the folklore of heroes, of creating heroes like a Don Bradman in the Sam Kerrs, which I think we can do and we must do, but that must be complemented with an infrastructure that can bring it to life. You know, these are points that are really well made. So I think that's the first step of this. The second step for me is what's the broader national legacy, you know, beyond that transcends football. And my argument is there is a nexus between our embrace of football as an Australian community and the role of Australia within the global community over the next generation. And the role that we choose to play as a nation, as a progressive nation potentially, or a nation that's going to take the challenges of the future head on, are linked with our embrace of football. So we can put our heads in the sand and pretend there's no climate change, or pretend that we can, you know, pretend that the future looks like the 1970s with a cell phone. Or we can actually create a really exciting, prosperous future for Australia within Asia. And football sits at the heart of that. And that's the ultimate legacy I'd see out of the 2023 World Cup. Yes, it's about embedding football as a legitimate part of Australia, which it isn't, unfortunately. It's been delegitimised, created as a legitimate part of the Australian culture, but then build on that and help football create the sort of Australia that we need to be to meet the challenges of the future.
Chris Nicker?
Yeah, I agree with those sentiments. I mean, the challenge from my perspective and head office perspective is to coordinate the disparate parts of the football ecosystem so they're rowing in the one direction. And that means telling our story a lot better to government, and to the extent that governments want to be internationally facing and building relationships, then our sport does it better than anybody else as far as connectivity. We're talking about gender equality. I mean, JD's been at the forefront there with the Matildas and that. I mean, that resonated around the world. And as we move culturally greater awareness about female sport and just communities generally, we can actually sell a very powerful narrative to government. And that's what we need to do over the next 2-3 years.
Richard Hines.
Yeah, I just think it's really encouraging that we're having this discussion. I just think legacy, as I've said, I think it's overlooked, taken for granted in various elements. And I think, you know, just the discussion itself, the fact that Chris is obviously involved in it and it's something that's been really carefully thought out is really encouraging. And I hope that, you know, 8 years after 2015, you know, in 2023, your equivalents aren't saying, oh, we didn't really think of that at the time. I think that groundswell that Ange talks about, that feeling of, you know, goodwill towards the sport, translates into really physical elements that improve the game for everyone.
Ange Postecoglou.
Yeah, look, if I see another AFL club trying to sell themselves in China and politicians jumping on that bandwagon and not understanding the opportunity that exists within football. I mean, I've been very vocal about it. And it's not because, and people will know, it's not because I hate the AFL. It's got nothing to do with it. I'm a Carlton man through and through. People know that about me. Part of my thing when I was a national team coach was to show people, you know what, you can love football in Australia and also love all the other sports. But that notion that when I still, up until recently, obviously when I was living in Australia, every boardroom I went into, every government office I went into, and I'd sit there and I'd talk with people of influence and they'd say, well, you know, my background's in rugby union or my background's in rugby league or AFL, but, you know, my kids play football. I really like it. It's a good game. And I'm going, mate, you've got no idea what you're missing here. You want to engage with Asia. You want to engage with the international community. Have your Indigenous sports. They're fantastic. We love them. We love the G on a Thursday night when Carlton beat the Tigers. I know it hasn't happened for a while, but anyway, we love all those things. But you're missing an opportunity here that you know what, if you walk into a boardroom and you have Timmy Cahill next to you, or you have an Aaron Moy next to you, Aaron Moy's currently in China. Next time a politician goes over there, why don't you just bring him into that meeting? It's going to get you a hell of a lot more traction. Trust me. You know, I'm living it now. I get more respect and credibility living here now because of we won the Asian Cup and I'm known as the Asian Cup winning coach than I ever did in my home country. They're the opportunities. And with the World Cup, the whole world will be looking. There's your engagement point. So, you know, I'd almost charge the politicians. You know what? You want to come to our games? You want to get a picture with Sam Kerr? Well, there's a price to be paid for that. And that price is that you make sure you use our sport as your conduit to everything you do internationally from now on. And you know, that needs to be still, you know, habit home. And I think JD's point's the most important one. It makes for a better country. It makes for a better Australia. Our game can make us a better country if we really embrace it. And unfortunately, we're still seen as the outsider. Some of us still see ourselves as the outsiders in our own game. So they're the kind of things that we have an opportunity to bridge, I think, with this World Cup. I think there's a hell of an opportunity there for us as a code and us as a country to have some real growth.
Guys, thanks so much for your contributions today. Look out for the final Football Belongs podcast episode. The other 8 episodes are available on Optusport platforms or Spotify. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.